Welcome. My name is Melinda. Melinda Papillo. And I am the dwelling in the word person this week. I have to say, I couldn't decide if I was more excited or more terrified to be called teaching faculty. relational stuff, and we're going to actually talk about this because I'm going to try and summarize. How many of you worked here yesterday? And this isn't calling you, and so that's what I thought. It looks like, I know there are some new faces.
Oh, we're here.
We're not here.
Oh, we're not.
I was like, okay. I'm like, that was more than I thought. I thought I recognized more of you. So I am going to do a little bit of summary just so you kind of know where we're landing, because yesterday was really where I made the case for this idea of broken table, what that actually means, and then why it is that I think it's a good idea or perhaps a need for us to at least to imagine what it would be like to take the church on a pilgrimage and all that would entail. So yesterday we set an intention. I think when you're going on a journey, there needs to be kind of this moment, because journeys are often difficult. And so whether it's sort of this sense of call or this moment of decision, there's this point where we set an intention to weather the days ahead. Because storms will come at you, emotional, physical, metaphorical, and otherwise. So having that intention in place is helpful. But I did note, some of you, I was watching you kind of get like, oh my goodness, what if I don't have an intention? A lot of times the intention, sometimes you just go with gumption, right? I mean, it's like, I'm going to go on this journey, and then by walking the path, your intention or your calling within that journey will sort of come to you. So don't fret if you haven't gotten an intention. I will tell you my intention. My intention in these days on this sort of 5-day journey that we're on together is to share some of the things that have been going on in my heart and mind and throw them at you, make you a little bit uncomfortable or perhaps a lot uncomfortable, and then listen to how you interact with them. Because I feel like this stuff has been kind of in captivity in my heart and mind. I shared it with some of my friends in a backyard last summer, this summer, called Broken Table. But it's really not come out to the light of day, so I am very kind of interested to hear how you are all interacting with this and embodying some of these ideas. So, to summarize, I'll summarize yesterday first. Just kind of some 3 points that I kind of want to get at. And then if some of you would be willing, if you feel like you've set an intention for yourselves and you would be willing to share them with the group, you don't have to. That might be a nice way to begin our time this morning. Sound good? Okay. So kind of 3 points. They're kind of fluffy. The Christian culture that we have normalized, this is point one. The human confines, the systems and practice that we've grown accustomed to in our churches, to use the metaphor of the tables that we have gathered around. These things no longer speak to today's culture. And I believe that our tables, our gathering ways, are ready to be upturned, and that we need to find a way to begin again. Now, I want to be very careful. This is not burning the house down, beginning again. This is like packing for a journey. Do you hear the difference? And we're going to be talking about what we're taking with us. So this isn't scrapping everywhere we've been, but deciding what essential pieces of our tradition, our church culture, our beliefs, we want to carry with us into the future. So that's kind of part one, that kind of where we've been, the culture that we've been living in, the table that we've been gathered around, I believe are ready to be upturned. Point two, the people that have ceased to gather around these tables or perhaps never even came, the people that we are needing to connect with are not done with belief, right? I mean, they're not in religious gatherings because they're in a state of disbelief or just that's not important to them. What they are done with, and some statistics have been done, is organized institutional religion. And what I have been continuing to find is that they're not wanting to be left alone, to go it alone, but they're still craving community and a place where they can think together. on things like faith and how we find our place in the world and who God is and how God works in the world. And finally, I really want to make this clear. I don't see the people that are not sitting at our current church tables as a them, but they are us. I believe the church is actually starving, if not significantly malnutritioned, because part of our body is missing. I think too often we as the church kind of look at ourselves as, oh, we've got the gospel and we're going to take it out to them. I believe that we are all created in the image of God, and the gospel is embodied in all of us, and when large chunks of us are not coming together around our tables, we're hungry and in pain. So that's kind of the second point. The third point is that as a Christian people, we gather around Christ, right? And we have used the language of that he is our way, he is the way, the truth, and the life, right? But what if Jesus is the way, which is our belief, what if his being the way is not actually a fixed path? What if we have been interpreting this text from John 14 with far too narrow of a focus? I think the power of the gospel has this capacity to include and redeem, to welcome the stranger, right, the outcast. What if Jesus' way is more of a manner of being or a way of doing things, and I would argue a movement, because remember, the original followers of Jesus were not called Christians, but they were followers of the way. So instead of a well-trod path, I think perhaps we might need a compass, where perhaps we would go on different adventures with what we believe and with our understandings, and then we would come back to one another to celebrate the different things that we have learned. So, those of you that were here yesterday, would you kind of say that's what you heard, more or less? Okay. Yes.
You know, I've been thinking since yesterday, which is dangerous, but the fourth point, maybe. And that is the people not in the queue who are not there because of a lot of baggage.
Right.
Hurt ones from the church. I ran into one in Germany who was still saying, I can't believe in something that did the Crusades and the Inquisition. What do you think about that? Or that, how do you put that in your framework?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly people who are not in the church because they've been hurt by the church or even just have... what they see the church has done in the past is violent, painful, unjust, right? Doesn't reflect Christ. So they would definitely be in the mix, which, as I think about what we're taking with us, I think we have to be more vocal. I mean, you know, Lutherans are kind of funny. We're like, oh, you know, faith is sort of something that... You know, you don't go out there and shout at the corners. I was volunteering for, if you're familiar with Lutheran Youth Encounter or Youth Encounter, I was in college and was interviewing with that. And I wanted to be part of it, but I said, I don't want to hit people over the head with my faith. I don't want to smack people with Bible verses. And I remember the interviewer, the person who was... receiving my application, she said, good, we don't want that either. But I think it has to do with us claiming which things are most really truly reflect who we are as Christian people. And then so when somebody says, I can't do because of the Crusades, you know, that the Christians have done this, that we can come back and say, yeah, but when I look at what the heart of who we are as a Christian gathering people, that is not this. Mm. I mean, for far too long, I feel like some of the most vocal expressions of Christianity have been some of the most destructive. And so I'm eager for us to kind of change that tide. Because like I argued yesterday, I'm almost even just getting chills thinking about it. I think that some of the stuff that we believe as a Christian people have the capacity to shape our political conversation right now. I mean, I think of the Lutheran understanding of paradox And we're going to get into this with Richard Rohr today, and I'm already begging your forgiveness for digging you into Richard Rohr, because I'm going to have us read a piece. We're going to dwell in his words today for dwelling in the word, and it's a little bit complex, but yeah. I mean, I think we're charting a new course and trying to allow ourselves to try on some new ways of being. A guy named Dwight Shively has talked about being an agile, kind of like an agile church. I've been playing around with ideas of improv. You know, where you come totally prepared for the moment. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to fly by the seat of my pants. I mean, you come trained, equipped, but then you kind of riff on what people are bringing to you to bring about the gospel, the good news, right? So, yeah.
I just had a thought, Steve, talking, you know, reflecting back what you said, is that most people don't trust organizations, political organizations or political governing bodies, and you know, the church is a huge organization, and they don't trust them if they've sinned against people within them and have not gone through a reconciliation process.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I have not seen the mm-hmm. church do,
mm-hmm.
is a real reconciliation process.
Thank you. Well, are there folks that would like to share an intention that you might, it doesn't even have to be your final answer. It could just be one that you're kind of chewing on right now. Yeah.
I kind of think you could do both. You could be in a community of faith, which Jesus encourages us to do.
Yep.
Because it's hard. In some ways, it'd be hard to have your faith maybe by yourself.
Yes.
But also, I think you could do the broken table. I belong to a church on Bainbridge Island,
mm-hmm.
great church.
Yeah.
And I think it's a family. I also volunteer at a homeless center.
Mm-hmm.
And last Friday or something, we got to talking with the two ladies run that center. People come in for showers and can have their laundry done. And this one lady asked me, how long have you been married? I said, it'll be 55 years. What kept you there for 55 years, or what happened? How did you get married?
Yes.
I think it's the spirit,
yeah.
And that led into a conversation.
Mm.
So I think you can do both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's a reason for different denominations too. That
mm-hmm.
we are not the same people, and we do not have the same needs.
Yeah.
And I was born and raised in a church, and it's fed and nourished me, and I've grown and changed, and it's, you know, I don't want the baby thrown out with the bathwater type of thing.
Right. Do I? Yeah. Because it's how do we hold ourselves in tension, right? Because I think, like, I was baptized United Church of Christ, don't tell the Lutherans, but, I've been born and raised in a Lutheran church, but, I mean, I worked in a Presbyterian Church of America church as a youth director when I was in college, and, you know, I've been, and Franciscans, I guess I hung out with them for a year, but I still have, like, certain things that I identify with, but how do I keep myself from staying so comfortable within that it's hard for me to interact with those that are different from me? Because I think the more that we keep sort of coming back like this, then I think we lose. So that's what I'm struggling with. I met a pastor in La Crosse that I was working with where they were so much working at trying to bring everybody in, and they had wide ranges of people, the heroin stuff going on in the La Crosse area is crazy. So, I mean, there were like drug addicts and there's all kinds of stuff coming in, and the church members were just exhausted. Like, I'm so glad that we've opened the doors wide, but we also need a place to rest. So I'm very much aware that we're living into a tension, does that make sense? How do we do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do we honor that, yes, I have certain needs, I need to be, I mean, I think of the village staff here, right? I mean, every week, they need to be able to care for them as a staff, but at the same time, they have to welcome this wide variety of people, and every mealtime, sit down with somebody you don't know, and, you know, like, how do you care for yourself and honor the dynamics of a community that's developing here, but also at the same time, be open to that which is different from you. Yeah. Any other intentions that, yeah?
I'm kind of one of those that's going on the journey and clarifying the intention. But I feel really called to provide places of safety.
Yeah.
I have no clue what that means. I know that's probably the next chapter of my life. But, so for me right now, it's, I think, looking for ways to provide places of safety.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? And this is the first time I've said this out loud, so maybe it is clarifying as I'm going.
Yeah. Thank you.
I think my intention is, as an older person, I like the routine of going to church and whatever. And so how do I bring that to the folks who don't want organization?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we balance that? And I think you mentioned that we need the people in the pews, the older people, because they have the money. So how does your church survive with people who are building, they don't know that they're supposed to give an offering.
Yeah.
And we experienced that a few years ago where we had a lot of people coming in our door, but they weren't giving any money and we weren't able to sustain.
Mm-hmm.
And now our church is like 3 years old and we're not going to say we're floundering, but we're, we're a toddler in many ways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We want to reach out, but how to do it?
Sort of spinning off of what Steve said and what you said regarding intention, I think my intention is to find a place that's not safe. Because I think my religion has been this place of safety, and I follow the rules, and I've done this and done that. And I think in that safety and predictability, I've not grown as a spiritual being. And so almost the opposite of what you said, Steve, I'm looking for a place that's not that safe place, but it's a spiritually authentic place for me.
Well, just to clarify, I'm not looking safe for me, it's for others.
I hear what you're saying.
But I hear that too.
And it's so interesting. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest and then I lived in Portland, Oregon for a while. And I was just aware of like the types of churches that are available, right? And where we're at on our path. And so I'm very aware, like there were something that I'd never heard of, Foursquare churches.
Oh yeah.
And they're very like, things fit into neat little boxes, right? And we would often get people coming to the Lutheran church after they had been in a Foursquare church for a while and realize that life doesn't fit into those neat little boxes. But I also know that some people's lives who have been through chaos, who've been through abuse, who've been through where everything was just, I mean, to have that clarity was the absolute embodiment of Christ for them, right? I mean, because they needed that structure. And so I don't want to dis sometime, perhaps aspects of how it is that we come to find ourselves at home and how we live out our faith. But at the same time, with a need for safety, how do we still continue to kind of push ourselves to those places of discomfort? Because honestly, if we're comfortable all the time, we're going to miss the Marys in the world, right? I love this tradition of standing for the Magnificat because we stand with people who don't have the same access, people who are on the margins, people who live in poverty, right? I mean, if we are kind of in our safety zones, I think we miss a great deal of the suffering of the world. Yeah.
I have always been a risk taker. He can allude to that. And so this kind of really appeals to me. If I get stuck in a rut, however a nice a rut it might be, I will, kind of decide, there's more out there. Isn't there more out there? And this is another opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to look at it. And little did I know that I passed it on to all three of our children, who are leading really interesting lives.
Yeah.
They don't feel you know, like they're without anything.
Yeah.
They're all doing, you know, well most of the time.
Yeah.
But I think that's where I'm at with this. I'm going to do the risks again.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I tend to play with words, and just in listening, the interesting thing for me is that we're talking about intention, and we're talking about tension.
And, intention. Yeah.
And to be in, it's it you know, to be in tension,
uh-huh.
or you know, somehow on a wire, or you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, all of a sudden I've got a tightrope going and trying to be on this tense tightrope of change or balance or whatever. Anyway, just a wordplay thought.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. That's homework, yeah.
I'm listening to you talk, and I'm thinking of the old church and the Pharisees and their this-is-the-way-it-is mentality. And in comes this rebel named Jesus that says, we're going and we're going to do things. Everything's going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like we're talking about, are we choosing to follow the old Pharisee way, or are we going to follow the rebel?
Right. And it's hard because what will happen is, and then even the rebels, right, they found this new life, and they were so excited that they had sloughed off the Pharisees and their rigidity, but they found this new great stuff, and then they want to start bottling the new stuff, right? And then the next thing you know, a couple generations down the road, suddenly they're living in the rules and regs of their new way of, right? And so I do believe that there's this rhythm that we have to attend to. And I feel like we're probably a little bit slow to shake up those tables. I think we're a little bit, you know, and for some good reason. I think, you know, you think of the changes that have happened in technology and science and all that kind of stuff. You know, perhaps the church needing a place of safety just to navigate everything else that's changing around us.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some good pastoral reasons that we haven't shaken this up yet, but I think it's time. So why don't we enter into today's topic of trying to decide what we want to pack. And you may be thinking about very physical things, perhaps practices, but I'm going to be kind of thinking about what kind of ideas or ideologies that we want to pack with us. So that's kind of where I'm going to go. And I'm going to try and make it practical, saying if this is an ideology that we're packing with us, specifically, we're going to look at Richard Rohr's idea of non-dual and dualistic thinking, and we're going to kind of dig into that. And then to think of the practical repercussions, like if we decide to pack his non-dual way of seeing the world, which he argues is the way Jesus saw the world, how would that affect how we interact with the world around us, and what kind of practices would we choose? So, all right, so Jesus said in Luke 17, chapter 33, although that's probably not how he would have qualified it, those who try to make their life secure will lose it, but those who lose their life will keep it. To come to Holden, my husband and I decided that this would be more than a simple change in geography. Greg felt called to leave his career in medicine. I felt called to leave all our stuff, and to Greg's credit, he did too, but I had a lot of stuff that I had brought into our marriage. My parents' divorce happened when I was in college, and through their moves and remarriages to other people, a lot of our family history, a lot of our family stuff kind of went to my brother. But he had gotten married, and so they were creating their home, and I was a single person at the time that all this was happening. So frankly, a lot of our family's things came to me. So some antiques that we grew up with, my grandmother's baby grand piano, several grandmother's dishes and china, lots of, and I grew up on the north side of Chicago, so I grew up using Yiddish, lots of tchotchkes. Do you guys know what tchotchkes are? Knickknacks, little cool art, and you know, beautiful stuff, like, oh, I can remember that sitting on the shelf, and I'm, you know, so neat stuff that sort of triggers childhood memories for me, right? Photographs childhood art. I actually found some artwork that I did in nursery school as I was going through boxes preparing for our move. And what has become a swear word in our family, memorabilia. How many boxes do you have in your home that are titled memorabilia, right? So all these things have accumulated, along with all the other things that I've just accumulated as a person going through the world. So to simplify and downsize everything, everything really needed to be considered. I didn't quite have the heart to take a box of memorabilia and carry it to the dumpster. Mm-hmm. That kind of tore my heart out. So much as I was able, I started to try and go through these things. Do you decide to keep it? And even if that's an easy decision, okay, I've decided to keep. So if I'm keeping it, do I pack it for Holden? Do I put it in storage, or do I give it to friend to hold on to until we get back?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because something, you know, it's like, oh, this is a really cool Instapot. It shouldn't sit in storage. Maybe there's a good friend of ours that would love an Instapot that can't afford it, and they can hang it. So we did things like that with our snowblower and some of these bigger things that we didn't want to store, but it didn't seem right to sell it and then buy it again. Right? I mean, all these things. So even if you're deciding to keep it, there's all these layers to decide what happens with it if you're keeping it. And then if you're getting rid of it, if you're not keeping it, if you're not packing it for the journey, then what do you do with it? Do you sell it? Do you give it away? Do you donate it to an organization? We ended up doing tons of research on which organizations take which kinds of stuff, and I found all kinds of charitable things that were going on in lacrosse that I didn't know about. Or do you just throw it away? And yes, we had two dumpsters, one small one and a large one, where things were going out of our house and being thrown away. And I think that was healthy. I'm guessing that many of you have been through a time like this in your life. You know that it is physically taxing and mentally taxing. It is emotionally taxing. And I believe that oftentimes you sense that God is calling you to this, that there's almost a spiritual practice to this downsizing process, a larger call, and I believe that it can be spiritually draining. Now, perhaps some of you think, oh, if it's spiritual, it shouldn't be draining. But I do believe that spiritual work being done within us that we are called to do can indeed be exhausting, and that that is God's intent. Because sometimes there's hard work to be done to get to life. So, to go through the process, you consider the differences between needs and wants, right? And you hear that all the time. But what I've been trying to wrestle is how you do that. And I think it's looking at your history and your future, right? Where you've been, your traditions, who you are as a person, but also to the future, to where you're going, and holding them close to see where they overlap in necessary ways. And what I mean by that is if you are trying to get rid of something, like one of the things that I had to get rid of, I didn't have to, but I chose to, were these two beautiful antique pieces. It was a buffet and like this corner curio cabinet, just the brass. They're sort of this mahogany, dark wood, and they had these brass handles on them. And just the clacking noise reminds me of my childhood, right? I love the smell of them when you open them. And it's not to say, by giving them away, we sold them at a very low price, and I felt good about that. It wasn't saying that they were bad, or they didn't have significance, or, you know, they somehow didn't hold meaning for me. They're still a valuable part of my history, but they weren't really overlapping with my future. So that's the tension. It's not saying, oh, we're getting rid of this stuff because they don't have meaning for us anymore. It's not that at all. It's saying which things that have held meaning for us actually overlap with the meaning of where we think we're going. Does that help? Mm-hmm. So we're not supposed to keep everything that we've had. I don't think we're supposed to get rid of everything that we've ever had. I believe that we hold our history and our future close and watch how they overlap in life-giving ways and then discard the rest. So my question is, can we do this as church? Right? What practices, perspectives, belief systems do we hold on to? And what do we set aside because they are not able to speak to our future? And that's not to say that they have not held deep value in our past, in our history. but it's just that they're not. I was trying to think of examples of this, and I, because I think you kind of have to live in between. There's no pure way to do this. The church that I was serving in, and there had existed for over 100 years, in the early 90s, they had rebuilt on a different location, because it was a very small church that was kind of enclosed, not very small, but it was a smaller congregation that was enclosed in a neighborhood, and so they needed a larger tract of land. And what they decided to do was to take the front stained glass windows out of the old building and move them into this very modern looking sanctuary that was very white with skylights. And I believe that the architecture of that very open, white, bright sanctuary has shaped the people to also be open. And there's clear windows down below that look out to the neighborhood. I think that's important. So, I mean, I think that that space has shaped them, but they carry this piece of history. And I go back and forth on whether or not that was a good idea for looking into, is that really something, stained glass windows, is that something you really want to pack with you into the future, right? But I also look at, you know, maybe there's something that you carry with you because you're not going to have the courage to make the transition forward unless you take some of those things. Like, I decided to keep my grandmother's baby grand piano. Now, perhaps that was to save relationship with my father, because I think he would have killed me if I sold it. But, you know, maybe that, in order for me to make this transition and to keep loving relations with my father and all those things, the piano got put into storage, and perhaps when I come back, I'll be ready to let that go. Or, I don't know, maybe there'll be something that I'll have a church community gathering in my house because there won't be a church building that I can afford to be in because of all these new ideas. So we'll be building church in our house and I'll have a piano. It'll be great. So, yeah, so as we think about, so just take a moment of quiet. I mean, think to write down some notes to yourself or just consider in your own mind, what are some things that are essential to you? And maybe some things that are essential to you that you might be willing to let go of. Because as you've watched the community, you're like, oh, I really love this language of the liturgy, but I'm not sure that it's translating well to newcomers when they come in. They feel like they're in a foreign land. I love it because it's familiar to me. But am I willing to let go of some of that, to bring in some new language that would help others feel like they're understanding what's happening in our worship on a Sunday morning? Some of those kinds of things. So just take a moment if there's write down some things that you really want to, or some things you want to, you know, you want to get rid of. There might be some real obvious things like, we need to ditch meatball left as suppers because they burn our people out. Yeah, I don't know what it is. What are some things you know you got to get rid of, but... So on our imagined pilgrimage this week, and you can keep kind of thinking, in our conversation with one another, can we be brave enough to do some of this taxing decision making? Can we hold some of these traditions that you're writing down, or perhaps just thinking about in our hands, and think, keep or toss?
My dilemma is that I don't know where you're going on the pilgrimage and that kind of thing. And so I don't know if it's something that's growing and providing life in my church, if that's something to be left alone and
right.
And get something new. So it's I'm obviously not having the same vision that you have, so I don't really have a vision for where I want. It's hard to say what I will leave behind or what I will take. And it's not a fear of losing my faith, but it's a, you know, I just...
What am I actually preparing for?
Yeah, what am I preparing
for? Yeah. So, that's a very helpful question, because I think part of a pilgrimage is you don't know what you're preparing for. I think there's some basic planning, mm-hmm. right?
Sort of like going on the path of the way.
Yeah.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Camino de Santiago in Spain. I mean, I think about some of the stuff that Greg and I were packing for here, right? And we knew kind of like what the logistics of Holden would require of us through some research. We packed that. But then when it came to some of the shifts in staffing, I had no expectation to step into some pastoral duties upon coming here. That was totally new. So all my pastor stuff that I probably would have packed with me if I was walking in, you know, as a pastor, you got to be prepared, right? I've got books, and I've got fancy clothes, and, you know, I've got all that, right? Even those little fun little collar things that you wear. I've got all that, but that's all in storage. I mean, I didn't know until less than a week before coming. I mean, we were already en route. So I hear your question. Like, I need to kind of know where we're going if I'm going to know what to pack. But at the same time, I really don't think the church knows where it's going.
Yeah.
I really don't think we do.
And it's going in different directions.
Mm-hmm. And I think we need to. Mm-hmm. So that's why this packing is such an essential, like, I really want us to think about it. You're less thinking about what can I bring with me that's going to make our future as church successful. I want you to think about, like, on a gut level, what do I need to exist? What do I need that is essential to my understanding of my love relationship that I have with my Savior, right? Like, if I were to talk about the core of what I believe and how I interact with God, if somebody says, why are you a faith-filled person? Like, or even if you wouldn't qualify yourself as a faith-filled person. Like, even if you're like, I don't even know what I believe, but I still feel like I'm called on this journey to figure some things out. What are those things that are kind of like your inner compass, right? I mean, like, what is it that you hold on to for direction? Yeah.
Well, I get confused about the Bible.
Don't we all? Anyone else get confused about the Bible?
Because, you know, when I was little, it was the King James, and I could never understand it.
Yep.
And then I got older, and one of the older ladies in my church, they had this really fun one that spoke modern-day words, and it's like, can I have that when you die? Sometimes we spoke it. So we bought a different copy version.
Yeah.
And it's like, I read it, and it's like, ha, that King James thing didn't say that, but I go back and find the right Bible verse, and it does say that, but not in my words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the Bible, and that would be my compass, but what will I share with people who don't believe? Because mm-hmm. if you don't have your compass like your Bible, where does your faith, like, where do you, how do you share it? You know, how do you... What do you use as your grounding tool?
To interact with others who don't share the same.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know. And like, I'm a person who likes to learn and read, so I would want a Bible to read, but then to understand it is crazy too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have all these interpretations, and now we look at parable Bible, although, and then there's all these other things like the Catholic Bibles and the mm-hmm. Jewish Bibles.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we don't have one sort of magic tool, I'll call it, what makes our faith stay true?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's, it was almost like you went into a different idea of what makes our faith stay true, because that's a different question than how do you talk to somebody if you don't have a shared language. I believe there are ways that we can talk to one another if we don't have the shared language mm-hmm. of Scripture, right? I mean, we have a shared humanity, we have, and I think we can very much share what we understand, why we connect with aspects of Scripture so deeply, and we can share that with another and hear what depth and rootedness they have in their own lives, even if it's not the same roots. But your question is valid. So if we are just kind of opening ourselves up to all these different perspectives, how do we still say, how do we hold to what is true for us, that that doesn't become mm-hmm. blurred? Or so think about that. What would you need to pack with you to allow you to stay open to others, but to still keep yourself rooted? Yeah.
I think it tossed with great care. The first congregation I saved was St. Olaf Lutheran in Crandall's Gap, Texas. It was where there'd been a Norwegian settlement.
Okay.
In Texas, of all places.
I thought it was just Germans in Texas.
I was finished my sermon this one Sunday, and about half or more of the congregation got up and left.
Well done.
And that was a shock. But what that was about was you were expected to commune at least once a year, whether you needed it or not. Mm-hmm. And so the people who left had already had communion for that year, and so it was normal for them to leave. Well, I didn't know that. And so I thought, oh man, what did I do?
Yeah.
And so, but still, it took them a long time to come around to communion once a month. And then finally, to once a year. Mm-hmm. But all of that transition has to be done with great care.
Yes.
And with tenderness for those people who, you know, have difficulty with leaving a tradition behind and adopting a new one, just as I did. I mean, my experience of shock is about what happens to a lot of people who get caught in a sudden decision by a congregation to change the way they do something. So I think it has to be done with great care.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what if you were to pack things like tenderness, pack curiosity, love, right? I mean, there's some obvious things like that.
You know, one thing that I struggle with, just where I am in my life, you know, my kids, I had kids later in life, and so they're college age, and they're, you know, just beginning to kind of launch on their own, and, you know, spending more time with my parents, and watching kind of, you know, when you're in a stage in life where your capacity to learn is you're in college and you're soaking up and you're learning, and then, you know, you get to a stage in your life where your capacity to learn is not on this roller coaster fast paced track, but it's slowing down, and those needs are so different. Mm-hmm. And then I think about, you know, times in your life when you're in extreme trouble, and then what do you need and what do you turn to? Mm-hmm. Dad, I think about when we were sailing on the Chesapeake and our sailboat capsized, and this was in the beginning of January. It was cold.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
It was cold, and nobody else was out sailing. And, you know, my grandfather, my dad, Kirsty, and I are in the Potomac in basically a storm, and so we can't climb up on the boat, and I'm in the water, and Kirstie's floating off, and here's my grandfather and my dad, and the only thing that I could, was going through my mind on a loop, was just the first part of the Lord's Prayer. So it was this very traditional part mm-hmm. of my religion mm-hmm. that's all that would come to me mm-hmm. over and mm-hmm. over. Mm-hmm. I didn't even finish it. You know, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, you know, over and over. Mm-hmm. And so you think about some of these very traditional mm-hmm. pieces of your religion. Mm-hmm. And in times of fear, mm-hmm. deep fear, mm-hmm.
it's sometimes it's these traditional pieces that you grab onto. Mm-hmm. You know, I watch my, you know, my mom in services, mm-hmm. and you know, there's a lot of things that are challenging for her now, but singing some of that liturgy, you know, saying those traditional prayers are the things that come back to you or stay with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need them in those times. So, you know, do those mean anything to my kids? You know, have I ingrained those things in them? What are they going to hold on to? Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. And mm-hmm. how do you appeal to these different and changing needs, you know, whether you're, you know, at either end of that tightrope, you know.
Yeah.
So I struggle.
You know, one of my prayers is, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Mm-hmm. I'd always want to take that with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I follow that by, I pray that in my doings at Bethany, I will be led by the Spirit. That's traditional church.
Mm-hmm.
In my doings with the Church of Steadfast Love, that's a church mm-hmm. for the homeless.
Yeah.
I pray that I can follow the Spirit in that. And the Spirit will lead me in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's a community. To me, it's a community. I have the community at a traditional church. I also have the community at a homeless church. I consider those, you know, it's much smaller, but I consider those my brothers and sisters.
Yeah. I mean, I truly, the more I spin this around, I think it has less to do with which traditions we mm-hmm. pack and more to do with which attitudes and dispositions that we pack along mm-hmm. with those things, right? So I promised you Richard Rohr, and we don't have enough time to dig into him, but we're going to anyway. I have 20 handouts. This conversation has been so engaging, so I kind of wanted just to ditch Richard Rohr, but he's really cool. So if nothing else, you can take this with you and kind of reflect on it later as you go through your day. If you're sitting next to a family member or friend that you'd be willing to share a copy with, that would be great, because I think we're just a little bit over the 20 copies that I have. So if you don't know, I was remiss. I forgot to put this on there. So if you want to know where that came from, it's a piece by Richard Rohr. He's part of a Center for Action and Contemplation. It's in New Mexico, in Albuquerque there, and this is the website. So if you want more resources like this was just like a daily... and I'm gonna read through this a little bit with you just because I want us to kind of understand as I think about things that we need to pack as a people going on pilgrimage. But anyway, www.caccenterforactioncontemplation.org. That's where you can find more of that. All right, so I'm just going to kind of read through this. Not normally my best practice, but I want to crash through it real quickly just so that we can kind of carry thinking about this into our days. So he writes, if we were trying to rebuild Christianity from the bottom up, we need to try to understand Jesus, the one who began it all, even if he never intended to start a new religion. I am convinced that Jesus was the first non-dual, and this is a word that I feel like he's kind of created, non-dual religious teacher of the West. And one reason we have failed to understand so much of his teaching, much less follow it, is because we've tried to understand his teaching with dualistic minds. In his life and ministry, Jesus modeled and exemplified non-duality more than giving us any systemic teaching on it. So that's part of the hard part. He modeled this more than he taught it. In our inability to fully understand him and seriously follow him, this may be partly because we have not been taught how to see non-dually ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You will hear terms of phrases like, it's hard to see something that you've never been taught existed, or, right? I mean, it's... we've thought highly of the mind of Christ, but there was little practical knowledge on how to get there. And so then he gives a little blurb there, so I'll skip to the next practice. Next paragraph. Dualistic thinking or the egoic operating system. God bless Cynthia Bourgeot, a friend and colleague. She's one of the people that works within the Center for Action and Contemplation. A very bright mind, but also reading her stuff, you just got to go slowly. So egoic operating system. It's our way of reading reality from the position of our private and small self. That's where that word ego is in there, right? So we interpret things through our private and small self. What's in it for me? How will I look if I do this? This is the ego's preferred way of seeing reality. It is the ordinary hardware of almost all Western people, even those who think of themselves as Christian. The church has neglected its central work of teaching prayer and contemplation, allowing the language of institutional religion itself to remain dualistic and largely argumentative. Anybody seen the language in our churches remain largely argumentative? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's going to explain more what he means by that. We ended up confusing information with enlightenment, mind with soul, and thinking with experiencing. Yet these are very different paths. The dualistic mind is essentially binary, so it's this either-or thinking. It knows things by comparison, opposition, and differentiation. So comparison, looking at these two different things, you know, kind of comparing them to each other, looking at how they oppose one another, how they're different from one another. It uses descriptive words like good or evil, pretty or ugly, smart or stupid, not realizing that there may be 100 degrees in between these two ends of each spectrum. Dualistic thinking works well for the sake of simplification and conversation, but not for the sake of truth or the immense subtlety of actual personal experience. Most of us settle for quick and easy answers instead of any deep perception, which we leave to the poets, the philosophers, and the prophets. Yet, depth and breadth of perception should be the primary arena for all authentic religion. Depth and breadth of perception should be the primary arena for all authentic religion. How else could we possibly search for God? Now, within the non-dual way of thinking, watch how he includes room for dualistic thinking, right? He says, we do need the dualistic mind to function in practical life, however, and to do our work as a teacher, as a nurse, a scientist, or an engineer. It's helpful and fully necessary as far as it goes, but it just doesn't go far enough. I mean, there are times when you just really need to decide safe, unsafe, right? You know, that sort of reptilian brain. This is helpful. It has kept us, you know, alive for generations and well for generations to come. But the dualistic mind cannot process things like infinity, mystery, God, grace, suffering, sexuality, death, or love. And this is exactly why most people stumble over these very issues. The dualistic mind pulls everything down into some kind of tit-for-tat system of false choices and two simple contraries, which is largely what fast food religion teaches. And usually without even knowing it, without the contemplative and converted mind, honest and humble perception, much religion is frankly dangerous. Mm-hmm. Mm. You see why I like Richard Rohr? Mm-hmm. Isn't he great? Yeah, he's a Franciscan, and I just think has been really doing some powerful thinking. He actually has kind of a school that you can apply to be into, but I think it's caught on, and right now there's like, you know, 10, 12 people per one position available in this two-year school that you can be part of, but yeah.
And also, I've locked a book club and many of the members have gone out to you. Like Holden, they have no
serious.
And they just love him and they worry because he's really close to being excommunicated with his thoughts.
Yeah.
So he's literally just in a heavy pain.
Oh, yeah.
He's very positive.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what we do. I mean, right? I mean, Jesus first and foremost. As people start really calling us to the places we need to go, we get too uncomfortable and we figure out how to shut them down. So so know if you come back to your church and start sharing some ideas that you have, they might not like you very much.
Well, we laugh about that, but I think that's a real barrier.
Yeah.
That there's this institutional hierarchy,
yeah,
that doesn't really want to extend into the membership, the congregation, into humanity.
Yeah.
And doing so sort of quells anything and everything that new members or members' ideas might bring in. And so that's the real challenge that I'm sort of looking at, is how do members of a church who care deeply about change when there's an institutional hierarchy that says not in this church you're not going to.
Right. And it may be figuring out how to live into it. I mean, you figure the church started in people's living rooms, right? And I think we go back to that. I'm just saying, to have a group of people of like-minded, I mean, because church is community, it's you know, the word, and I would say gather around the table, have food together. And do a lot of praying, a lot of praying.
I was just gonna say that I think that that is the way,
yeah,
is to have those like minds together in conversations with each other. We spent a year in discernment. It was a bunch of couples that were all becoming empty nesters, and we all knew that what appealed to us was mission, and our church basically loved to feed itself. And they were really good at feeding themselves, but we were like, whoa, we are just so inspired by our kids who went through mission. And so we sat together for a year in discernment, and then focused and unanimously chose a mission. How weird was that?
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, what a...
How Christian was,
you know,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what a, you know, example of the Holy Spirit being present with us in our journey. So I think that's a great way to do it. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's definitely worked within our church.
I think it's all, you know, about balance. And I think being with your like-minded people is really important, kind of going to your core. The other way that, I mean, I've had the absolute honor and privilege to do a lot of travel, both for work and otherwise. And it's pretty amazing when you step into being with someone and eating with someone who is incredibly different from you, how they cease to be different from you.
Yes.
And sometimes it's just taking that risk of, and seeing the invitation to just be with people who you think you have nothing in common with. And they, in my case, end up being some of people who I consider part of my extended family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that not seeing the them anymore.
You talk about getting into a place where it's you're going back to the church and saying something that people aren't willing to accept. I do that all the time, with unintentionally, but I put myself, and one of the biggest ones was the choir had just sung this most amazing piece. It was so inspirational, and I clapped. That's all I did. I started clapping, and then other people joined in clapping. But then the minister said, let's now share the peace with everyone except the one that started the clapping.
What?
And in the discomfort, it brought a lot of feelings of, and a lot of people came over intentionally,
mm-hmm.
to shake my hand.
Yeah.
But, and I had other, then I went, to, of course, and made an appointment to visit with him, but.
No, I mean, well done, that's courageous. Yeah.
No, but I mean, it was like, yeah. Here, this was most amazing, and other people felt it,
yeah.
too, but nobody was, and it just, I didn't even think of it. I just was like, because it was expressive, and it was like worshiping and spoke,
yeah.
to me. But for him to say that, it would, but it worked for the good, because mm-hmm. other people felt that, and then it became more, a little bit more open, and it mm-hmm. happened a little bit more. But and being unintentional was a good thing. Situation of going with your heart and your spirit.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. I'm sorry that happened.
I'm not Christian. And I was born into a Jewish family, and but I'm not an organized religious person. And over the last 3 years, what I've found my church is Al-Anon, which doesn't have leadership. And I think this is totally key. I think that power is, we can't handle it as humans. And there are lots of good people. Everybody who's a leader starts out good, but we can't do it. And in Al-Anon, it works by everybody. You know, you have a 6-month tops, you know, position, and then it goes on to somebody else.
Yeah.
And it's a huge organization, and yet it manages to run itself.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that's something that can happen. I mistrust pretty much all institutions, companies, and things like that. They always seem to be out for themselves in a psychopathic way. It's beyond. It's
security.
It's really.
Thank you for saying. Yeah, I know that this is when I kind of tried to map some of this out for the leaders that be, because I mean, the more I talk myself into this, I'm talking myself out of a job, out of health insurance, out of the primary health of life, right? Because institutions provide those things. Collaborative leadership was kind of one of those models, because I can't stomach pastor-centric churches anymore. Mm-hmm. I even feel a little bit ill, me standing and you all sitting, right? But I, you know, this is kind of the mode that we're in. I think you've touched on something that has, that I've certainly been chewing on as well. Because I think it's theologically problematic, quite frankly. Because, right, we stick the pastor up in front, we throw a robe on them, and then we give them sometimes even high places to speak from. And I know in the old days they didn't have sound systems, and you stick them up there, and then you can hear better and fine. And the black is supposed to show the pastor's sin, and then the white robe going over is supposed to show how they've been washed by baptism. There's great history behind why we do those things. But what it's done is that it has put the pastor on a pedestal, and that's the person that knows stuff. I try to get my lovely church ladies, you know, sitting down in the basement, and to get them to talk about what they think about some of these things, and they're like, oh, I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't know how to read my Bible. And I thought, oh my gosh, what if we... But if we could model some kind of collaborative, permeable... I know the Quakers have kind of figured this out. I had some long conversations with some Quaker folks, because they have a much more... level playing field when it comes to leadership, but thank you for that. I think I'll leave us there, and I mean, and kind of riffing on, I would beg of you to pack two things, whatever else you stick in your luggage to kind of carry on this pilgrimage, pack love and curiosity. Love and curiosity, because if that pastor had heard you clapping, I mean, I would have fallen in love with you to see how you had just been moved by what the choir had done. I would have been curious what motivated you to clap, right? I mean, those are two, and I don't want to fall. I mean, maybe he was being silly. I have no idea. But pack love and curiosity. I think that's going to carry you a long way. But, enjoy chewing on Richard Rohr today. And tomorrow, we will enter out into the unknown. You ready? Okay. All right. Thank you for being here today.